Those shots are being fired on 12th Street. Two tanks have just moved into that area.
This is about the 1967 riots.
From Michigan Radio, this is Ashes to Hope, Overcoming the Detroit Riots. I'm Christina Shockley.
July 1967 was not just a riot.
These people looted from Belle Isle to 8 Mile.
After the riot,
it was never the same.
Many, many whites in the suburbs are convinced that the riot ruined Detroit.
40 years ago, the riots of 1967 changed the city of Detroit. People changed, landscapes changed, neighbors changed, even music changed. A look at what happened that summer and where we are now on Ashes to Hope, Overcoming the Detroit Riots. First, a look at the latest news headlines. Years ago, on July 23rd, sections of Detroit were consumed by the deadliest riot of the 1960s. It started when police raided an after-hours bar near the corner of 12th and Claremont and arrested 82 people. What followed was 5 days of rioting.
I remember it. Smoke,
tanks on the streets.
Lawlessness and violence are continuing.
At the end of the 5 days, 43 people were dead, and large areas of the inner city were smoldering in ruin. From Michigan Radio, this is Ashes to Hope, Overcoming the Detroit Riots. I'm Christina Shockley. Over the next hour, we're going to take a look at what happened during those 5 days of violence and why. But mostly, we're going to take a look at the lasting effects of the riots on the city of Detroit, on the state, and on individual people whose lives were changed forever. The riot of 1967 is one of the defining events in Michigan's history. When people talk about Detroit, many remember a safe, bustling metropolis back in the city's heyday in the 1940s and 50s. But ask them about today, and they point to areas of blight, poverty, and crime. For a lot of people, the 1967 riot was the turning point.
A lot of people, some businesses, left the area.
I guess it probably increased the racism in and around Detroit.
I grew up here. I can remember my mom saying she didn't want to be in a neighborhood where they really were, we were the only white people.
I think they were afraid after that riot, so away they went.
To my knowledge of those times, it probably hurt the economic base a lot. A lot of businesses were damaged, were lost.
Well, what we see today, people not finding Detroit a desirable place to live, and of course the population is gone, and so there's not the taxation support.
Haven't been able to gain a lot of what they had at that time back.
Public perception is often that the riots wrecked the city. People say the riots caused racism, white flight, and economic difficulties. But those are the exact things many say are the reasons for the violence that summer. But before we start unpacking the legacy of the rioting, we'll start with the story of what actually happened during those 5 days in Detroit, from three people who experienced the riots firsthand.
A summer Sunday for most is one of the good things in life. It's a day for picnic, swimming, golf, a drive in the country, a day with friends and family. July 23rd was a Sunday.
I got an urgent call that woke me up. They said to get over there as soon as you can because it looks like there's going to be big trouble there.
And that was the beginnings, as it turned out, of a ruckus, we'll call it.
It was a beautiful, clear day, and I see these plumes of smoke as I'm driving down to my house in northwest Detroit.
I'm Congressman John Conyers, and I represent the 14th District of Michigan, and that's northwest Detroit.
My name is Ronald Hewitt, and in 1967 I was working for the City of Detroit's Housing Commission, and I had an office on 12th Street near Taylor.
Yeah, Philip Nye. I was news director at WKNR Radio in 1967.
The spark, as always, was a minor incident. It was routine police action, a raid on what Detroiters call a blind pig, an after-hours bar.
They threw a woman down the steps, and that's what really got everybody angry.
It was just an outpouring of rage, that had been pent up.
It seemed to be a continuation of a buildup of a lot of hard feelings that had developed across the years, because the police had been running, they called them the Big Four, the tactical police.
And they had a place over there right near Blaine and 12th Street, in the alley there, there was a light post there. And when they were upset with some person there in the community, these street people, they would go around in that alley and make them hug that post. They used to call it the whipping post. They would hug that light post while the cops beat them.
I got there that morning. It was Sunday morning. And the great crowd had gathered around.
They were looting. They were broken windows. They had started fires. There were several businesses burning.
We don't know, but they just shot one over. Stay undercover. All uniformed men, stay undercover.
They finally brought the National Guard in.
A bunch of young kids, really, from the northern part of Michigan, and they were terrified. They would have been terrified if nothing was going on, because it was such a strange environment for them. They never saw that many black folk in their lives, not even in the movies.
I'll never forget the feeling that I had when I looked out of my own windows on 7438 Dexter and heard these tanks rumbling down Dexter. It was like an invasion.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street. Two tanks have just moved into that area. Those first shots you heard were 50 caliber.
I was standing on the corner, as I remember, and this tank rolled up and started firing at this three-story apartment building across the street.
This area full of snipers tonight.
If you listen to that, there was some gunfire in addition to the 50 millimeters that this tank was firing, blowing the porches off of this building because they thought they had seen a sniper over there. Whether they did or not, who knows? But it was a pretty frightening situation.
At midnight Monday, the president went on the networks.
Law enforcement is a local matter. It is the responsibility of local officials and the governors of the respective states. The federal government should not intervene except in the most extraordinary circumstances. The fact of the matter, however, is that law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan.
Now, we already had the police who were stretched to their limit. We had the National Guard, we had the state police. And then we added the U.S. military.
They sat for a while at, the fairground and at City Airport before the federal government released them to come in. And once they came in, there were enough of them that they covered the territory, and that stopped it.
There started to be meetings and to get together to try to, do some things to give black folk to a chance to speak on these issues, as a way of venting their feelings. For the first time, there seems to be somebody listening. It took this to get it, but, now some of them appear to be listening.
The Detroit riot of 1967 was and still is the largest riot of citizens in the history of this country. It hasn't been matched, and I don't say that proudly.
A lot of people who even felt it was regrettable felt it was something that had to happen, that you couldn't get, obviously, any attention any other way. And, you know, and in the final analysis, you can't make an omelet unless you break some eggs.
On Friday, the last major fire was reported. And on Friday, the president again addressed the nation.
There is no American right to loot stores or to burn buildings or to fire rifles from the rooftops. That is crime, and crime must be dealt with forcefully and swiftly and certainly.
Those voices you heard were Congressman John Conyers, Ronald Hewitt, and Philip Nye. Was what happened a riot or a rebellion? In recent years, many black Detroiters have come to prefer the term rebellion. Grace Boggs is of Chinese descent, but she and her African-American husband were Detroit's leading radical intellectual theorists. They have always argued that the events of 1967 were not a riot, but a real, if unfocused, rebellion by the oppressed against the unfair conditions of their lives.
July 1967 was not just a riot or just a breakdown of law and order, as the media still call it. It was a righteous rising up against a police occupation army and against the injustice of white power governing a city becoming majority black. In other words, it was a rebellion, as most Detroit blacks called it at the time. But it was not a revolution, because it did not begin to create the new values and new institutions that inner-city youth, who were the main actors in the rebellion, needed to give meaning to their lives now that high-tech and deindustrialization were making their labor expendable. This is not just a question of semantics. It's only by being clear that July 1967 and the other urban uprisings of the 60s were rebellions and not riots, all revolutions, that we can appreciate what they did and what they did not achieve. Because the urban rebellions were on such a huge scale, the establishment was forced to admit blacks to high positions in all kinds of institutions. This struck an important blow against racism, but it did not provide an answer to the chaos spreading in our inner cities. This would require the projection of a radical revolution in values, from a society idolizing economic growth to one honoring community and our relationships with one another. That is why we founded Detroit Summer 14 years ago, to involve young people in rebuilding, redefining, and re-spiriting the city from the ground up.
Grace Lee Boggs is the founder of Detroit Summer, a group focused on restoring Detroit through local cooperation. Their latest project, Detroit City of Hope, is a campaign to transform grief into hope by uniting grassroots groups in Detroit in remembrance of the violence in the summer of 1967. Coming up.
You have no right there. No right.
Why do you say that?
Because there's no place for... They don't want you down there.
Who's they?
The people who live there.
I live there.
Disagreement over who has a place in Detroit lives on in a family argument between a granddaughter and a grandfather who was a police officer during the rioting. That story in about 10 minutes on Ashes to Hope. From Michigan Radio, this is Ashes to Hope. overcoming the Detroit riots. I'm Christina Shockley.
And I overheard a conversation between two police officers
into the fire staff.
One police officer,
"They have no concern for us."
White officer
was commenting.
After the riots, whole city blocks were gone.
The lasting impact for me is I lost my dad.
And it was never the same for me.
Lee Forsythe was living at the Algiers Motel when the riots made their way to his front door.
I could hear the shooting on the first floor, so I stopped on the second floor, and my friend Carl must have went down because he knew I was kind of frightened. So he proceeded all the way down to the first floor. The police come in and start harassing everybody, making everybody line up on this here wall. And I see my best friend in a pool of blood right in here. And a lot of 18 years old, and that was the first time I ever seen somebody die. And then the police, he grabbed me and asked me, "What did I see?" And I told him, "I see a dead man." He hit me across the forehead here. Then he asked me, "What did I see?" Frightened, I said nothing. He put me on the wall, and then they proceeded to beat us. It was supposed to be a good life. And little did we know that was going to be the worst day of our life.
In 1967, the Detroit Police Department was overwhelmingly white. The population of Detroit was increasingly black. There was a growing gulf of mistrust between the police and the people. Today, there are a lot more African Americans on the police force, but the gulf of distrust remains. There are allegations of chronic police brutality. The police department is trying to improve its relationship with the community, but as Tracy Samilton reports, serious questions are being raised about whether it's working.
On a hot day this summer on a side street off Rosa Parks Boulevard, a group of balloons bobbles in the wind, surrounded by teddy bears and handwritten signs. Detroit activist Ron Scott gestures to the people huddling on the front steps of a nearby house and says they should be left alone because they're grieving.
This is where a young man by the name of Jamon Royal was killed by the Detroit police the other night.
The shooting happened four blocks from where the 1967 riot started. Police are still investigating, but eyewitnesses say police killed Royal without cause. Ron Scott is the head of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. He says the shooting shows how little police have changed since the riot. The sentiment is common. Some people believe things are just as bad between the police and the people as they were in 67.
Because they're still killing the kids.
At a nearby cafeteria, Marie Fountain eats lunch with a group of friends. She says there are plenty of good cops, but the bad ones are getting away with murder. Only one person says she trusts the police here. Everyone else says they're wary of them, especially the white cops. They say the police disrespect them. But police say the citizens don't respect them either. The department recently hired a group associated with members of the Nation of Islam called Educating Neighborhoods to Obey Those in Authority. In the next 2 years, the group's leader, Dennis Muhammad, hopes to train 25,000 people to avoid antagonizing the police.
A lot of the conflict the citizens sometimes bring upon themselves because they don't know the proper way to talk or how to respond to law enforcement.
Despite the name, Educating Neighborhoods to Obey Those in Authority, the group will also try to convince thousands of police officers to be more respectful and use less force. The group has hired newly retired Detroit police officer Ron Griffin. He's a big, muscular man who says as a cop, he used his head a lot more than his muscles. He remembers one arrest where many officers might have immediately pulled their weapons.
A man had a gun that I stopped, and I got him out the car. I just talked to him. "Come on, brother, talk to me." He was like, "Man, I got a pistol on me." I could have threw his head through the window, anything. He had a gun. I said, "All right, let me put the cuffs on you. You straight." I reached in, got the gun. I was real cool about it.
Griffin says most police officers are well-meaning, and he hopes he can encourage them to avoid using force. A lot could depend on it.
The climate could be in Detroit. We can have an explosion. But there are still some people that quell enough fires They keep it from becoming a huge blaze.
But sparks are flying. Police have killed 7 men this year. The department says it's tough out there. There have been a record number of assaults on police. 1,000 officers have been laid off in the past 7 years, and the economy is causing more stress in neighborhoods. Despite all those things, Assistant Police Chief Ralph Godby admits there's a problem. At a recent police commissioner's meeting, he says even one death of a citizen at the hands of police is a matter of concern.
Even if we're justified, we're still not satisfied with the fact that somebody lost their life. We still need to vet it, look at it, and see could we have done something else.
Assistant Chief Godby says the department is taking several approaches to reduce police shootings, but it won't be an overnight fix. Activists like Ron Scott say that's not good enough. He says the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality thinks the police could do more.
And while all these people are talking, all these people are speculating about what to do, people are dying. Young men are dying in the streets.
Everyone who was interviewed for this story agreed that many of the same conditions that contributed to the riot of 1967 still exist. It could happen again. It could happen tomorrow. I'm Tracy Samilton.
Here's a story about a man who moved his family out of Detroit in the summer of 1967 and his oldest grandchild who lives in the city today. The grandfather is Dan O'Mara. He was a police officer in Detroit during the riot. The grandchild is reporter Sarah Hewlett.
My grandfather has a gift for argument. In his younger days, he moonlighted for labor legend Jimmy Hoffa. As my granddad puts it, he was hired to stir things up at meetings. These days, he mostly stirs things up at his kitchen table with whatever family member is sitting next to him. Recently, that family member was me. We were talking about the fact that I live in Detroit. I think of my decision to live there as an investment in the most historic and interesting city in Michigan. My grandfather does not see it that way.
Oh, I think you're a fool. I do.
My granddad has a similarly blunt assessment about his decision to move his family out of Detroit in 1967. He says the block on the city's northwest side, where the O'Mara clan lived, was not exactly a tight-knit community.
Nobody got along. Fighting bunch of bastards.
Part of the reason for the acrimony was that my grandparents had 12 kids on their 40-foot lot. He says their neighbor on one side put up a hedge to keep those kids from running into his yard. But hedges can be jumped.
So what does he do? Puts a barbed wire through there. Barbed wire. And I know the kids were upset. They were upsetting him. But geez, you had to go, you know. So that's why you had to get the hell out. You had to get out of there.
So he and my grandmother moved their children to the farmhouse where he grew up, on a dirt road just a few miles off Lake Huron. My granddad didn't have enough years in with the Detroit Police Department to retire yet, so he continued to work, driving back and forth from the farm to the city. About a month after the move, he was working his regular weekend shift in Detroit's old 10th Precinct when the riot started. I asked him what he thought about the police department's reputation for brutality against the black community.
Well, I think they were. We were. I mean, let's not forget that. Yes, we were. There was things that I did that I'm not proud of. I'm not proud of. No. There was things. I think you have to go back to the old Irish when the Irish came over here. They weren't well liked either, you know. And I think it was the same way.
The stereotyping of a whole community was something my grandfather could relate to as a grandchild of Irish immigrants. But it was a way of thinking in the police force that he took part in, even if he recognized its bigotry.
I don't know why we didn't get along better with them. But we didn't. You know, they were troublemakers. You just didn't trust them at all.
When I press my granddad on some details, he often has a frustrating answer. That's just the way things were. And he's just as sure about the way things are today, like the fact that living in Detroit is a bad idea for his granddaughter.
You have no right there. No right. None.
What do you mean?
Because that's not a place for a young person.
Who is it a place for?
Old person's home or something like that.
Why do you say that?
Because there's no place for... They don't want you down there.
Who's they?
The people who live there.
I live there.
I know, but you can't walk the streets. You can't. Where do you go for gas for your car? You look around. You got to do this. You can't go shopping. You can't go to your doctor. There's no doctors. Nothing in the goddamn place anymore.
I'm not sure what I can tell my granddad that would make him understand why I live in Detroit, but I do think I have a purpose here. It's to tell the stories of the people who have not left. I'm Sarah Hewlett.
And I overheard a conversation between two police officers back into the fire one police
they have no concern for us.
A white officer past has been was commented
after the riots, whole city blocks were gone.
The lasting impact for me is I lost my dad.
And it was never the same for me.
Ivory Williams was 17 years old in 1967.
Mama Clay Brooks, she was my grandmother. She's the one that instilled the values and principles that I feel I have today. I'm a longtime Detroiter. Grew up on the north end of Detroit, which is right near where the 67 riots happened. We didn't know it at the time, but we were the poorest family in the neighborhood. At that time, I could never get enough to eat, always hungry. We would borrow from every house in the neighborhood, you know, cup of sugar, you know, milk, anything. And it became old hat. It wasn't, we didn't like it, but we didn't feel embarrassed or bad about it because that's the way things were. So the second or third day of the riots, the looting is spreading from the 12th Street area to the surrounding neighborhood. And what happened was, it's two or three days in, we weren't going anywhere. We were staying close to home. And we were sitting on the front porch with my grandma. And a group of people came down the street, four or five men carrying boxes and bags of goodies that they had looted from these stores on Oakland. They knew about our family. They knew Mama Clay Brooks, you know. And so they came in and they turned right into our house. Smiles on their faces, you know, look, Mama Clay Brooks, we've got some goodies for you. And she stood up and she walked to the front of the porch and she said, no, don't bring that stuff in here. We don't want nothing that's been stolen or taken from others. Me, I'm halfway out of my seat to help them bring those groceries in, you know, because, wow, food. But when they left, she told us that it's never right to do wrong. And that's stayed with me to this day. You know, there are opportunities to not do the right thing, but you have a choice.
Detroit resident, Ivory Williams. Just about everyone who lived in or near Detroit at the time has a story of how they were changed by that summer. Some of those people were musicians. As Jennifer Guerra reports, the rioting changed the Detroit sound.
If you turned on the radio in 1965, this was the sound coming out of Detroit. But just 3 years later, the sound coming out of Detroit was this. The first song by the Supremes is classic Motown. The second is by the band the MC5. It's a remake of John Lee Hooker's Motor City is Burning. Hard to believe the sound of Detroit changed that much in 3 years. But a lot can happen in 3 years, especially if those years fall in the mid-60s.
To me, it was sort of like the calm before the storm.
David Carson is the author of Grit, Noise, and Revolution, a book about Detroit rock and roll.
You had records, you know, Happy Together with the Turtles, and You Baby and the Lovin' Spoonful had their records, you know, Daydream. And not to say that it was meaningless music or it was light and reply, it just was a nice feeling, you know, a feeling of hope.
But Carson says by 1967, that big, white, fluffy cloud of hope was starting to cloud over. Across the country, people began to focus more on the war in Vietnam. The civil rights movement was heating up, and race riots were burning in many major cities.
Detroit was no exception. People in Detroit were mad, especially people in their 20s and 30s. The time was ripe for a youth movement, thanks in large part to three specific events, all of them unique to Detroit. In the fall of 1966, the Grandy Ballroom opened. It was a rock venue where bands could experiment.
And there were new newspapers that came along in Detroit. Fifth Estate, in particular, was kind of a left-wing liberal voice that regularly criticized the government.
Then, in early 68, underground radio stations started popping up. All of these things gave Detroit's burgeoning youth culture an outlet to express their frustration. MC5 guitarist Wayne Kramer says there was plenty of frustration to go around, especially after the Detroit riots.
That changes you. You can't live through something like that and have that same kind of naive belief that everything's going to be fine. Everything wasn't fine, and it wasn't going to be fine.
Kramer says when he saw his city at war, it made him realize something needed to change.
The MC5's role was as the underground news service, you know, as messengers. We absorbed what was happening around us and then channeled that back through the songs and the spirit of the music. There was this assertiveness and commitment that I think typified what young people were feeling of our generation.
Assertiveness is almost an understatement. The music was rough and aggressive. It had attitude, a far cry from the super smooth sounds of Motown. And the MC5 weren't the only ones making that kind of noise. The Bob Seger System, the Stooges, SRC, they were all pioneers of this new pre-punk sound. 40 years later, the punk sound is alive and well in Detroit. You can hear it in current bands like the White Stripes, the Dirt Bombs, and the Questions. Drew Bardo is lead singer for the Questions. He draws a lot of inspiration from the bands of the late 60s, especially the MC5.
They influenced me on, I guess, a spiritual level in a way, and a political level. I guess what I've learned from them is just to get involved and not to really worry about the consequences. Which sounds a little bit reckless, but that's rock and roll, you know, it's dangerous.
Of course, no matter how dangerous or revolutionary a song is, it's not going to change the world. Drew Bardo knows that. So does Wayne Kramer of the MC5. But Kramer says a song can play a part in the process of change. It can get people to listen. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Some of the white families that have left Detroit are now making their exit complete. They're having their dead ancestors dug up and moved from Detroit cemeteries to the suburbs. Coming up, we'll take a look at the roots of white flight.
Many, many whites in the suburbs are convinced that the riot ruined Detroit.
The myths and realities of white flight when Ashes to Hope continues.
Johnny can do. My hometown's burning down to the ground. Western and Vietnam. Well, it started on 12 and Claremont that morning. I just don't know what it's all about. Well, it started on 12 and Claremont that morning. I don't know what it's all about. The fire wagon kept coming.
It's Ashes to Hope from Michigan Radio. Before the 67 riot, blacks were still a minority in Detroit. But so many white families moved out in the years following that blacks quickly became the majority. Today, the city is more than 80% black. Vincent Duffy has this look at the white flight from Detroit.
White families started moving out of Detroit long before the riot.
In fact, the exodus began right after World War II. And by the early 1960s, about 20,000 whites left Detroit every year. Then came the riot. And that number doubled. And it doubled again the year after that. So that by 1968, 80,000 white people moved out. Kevin Boyle is a history professor at The Ohio State University who studies Detroit in the 1960s. He says even though the city's white flight began long before the riot, that's what people point to as the reason so many fled.
And so if you go out to the white suburbs today, you go out to Warren, St. Clair Shores, Livonia, what you're going to hear over and over again from whites is that Detroit was this wonderful city in the 1940s and 1950s, but then came the riot and the city was destroyed. Well, that's not true. Detroit wasn't a wonderful city in the 1940s and the 1950s. It was always a troubled place. But many, many whites in the suburbs are convinced that the riot ruined Detroit.
Boyle says the reason is that after the riot, a combination of racism and concern about falling property values created an irresistible panic among whites.
Realtors would try to send signals to whites in neighborhoods where African Americans hadn't moved in, that in fact African Americans were moving in. So you put a kid on the street riding his bike down the street, a black kid you hire, or you hire an African American woman to push the stroller. And what that does is it triggers the rumors, oh, they've moved onto our block, and that's what induces the panic.
And real estate companies took advantage of that panic to cash in by blockbusting, making a commission on each house as whole neighborhoods turned over. There are stories about vandalism and threats against the first black families to move into previously white neighborhoods, but for most black families, the transition was not so dramatic. Henry White is a black man who bought homes in mostly white neighborhoods twice, hoping to get his kids in better schools. Today, the whites live on a typical suburban street in Southfield. He's never had any problems with his white neighbors, but he did watch them slowly move away.
There is this perception, if a black family move in or the neighborhood becomes more black, then it's going to deteriorate. It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If someone is going to sell their home and try to get what they can and get out, they probably will take less. And I believe that realtors take advantage of that. You got to get out while you can because, you know, they're moving in.
That get out while you can mentality was intense in the years following the riot. In 1967, Pam Clark and her parents lived in the same Detroit neighborhood where her grandparents grew up. When her father heard about the riot, he drove to her job and made her come home. Before the next summer arrived, the Clarks moved from Detroit to South Lyon.
I do know that the neighborhoods around us were beginning to be integrated. So I'm sure that was somewhat on their mind when they made that decision, and I'm sure the riots just added to it.
Lots of big cities have experienced white flight, but the riot put Detroit's in overdrive. It generated a fear, and that fear, combined with racism, blockbusting, and court-ordered school busing, drained the city of its white population. Clark feels because Detroit was historically segregated, it was set up for white flight.
And so rather than having an eventual integration of the races in neighborhoods, you had families fleeing because of this whole mindset that Detroit had had since, gosh, the turn of the century, I guess.
And that mindset continues. Recent census data indicate that the new flight from Detroit is among middle-class black families. And as they move into Detroit's suburbs, white families continue to move farther away. I'm Vincent Duffy.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. 6 years after the ashes of 1967 cooled, Coleman Young was elected mayor of Detroit, the first African American ever to hold that office. He was tough, bitter, and brilliant. And he knew that his victory was a direct result of the Detroit riot. Later he said that, "I knew that this had only happened, that I was taking over the administration of Detroit, because the white people didn't want the damn thing anymore. They were getting the hell out, more than happy to turn over their troubles to some black sucker like me." In the years after the riot, there was no more polarizing figure than Coleman Alexander Young. When you ask older whites in Detroit suburbs why they left the city, they are as likely to say Coleman Young as they are to say the riot. He was mayor for 20 years. There was plenty to criticize about the way he ran the city. He had a chip on his shoulder the size of a cinder block. But if you want to know what it was like to grow up black in Detroit before the riot, you need to read Coleman Young's memoir, Hard Stuff. It is one of the best analyses of July 1967, seen from the perspective of a militant black survivor who by then was part of the establishment as a member of the state Senate. Rather than calling it a riot or a rebellion, Coleman Young called it an explosion, a chemical reaction to the prevailing conditions. Though he was always accused of playing the race card, Young was a far more nuanced observer than white Detroit, and maybe even black Detroit, ever knew. He said that at the start, the riot was as much about consumerism as about race, a revolt of underprivileged, overcrowded, hot, and irritable citizens. He felt the authorities, namely the National Guard and the police, did their damnedest to turn the affair into a race riot. Young doesn't say that the citizens of Detroit were justified in destroying their own community, or that the police should bear all the blame. But as the riot turned violent, the real target of the rioters was the white man in the blue uniform. Had the riot never happened, Detroit would still be an aging, majority black city with the problems older cities everywhere face. But because it did happen, everything is worse. Whites fled in droves. Nearly 200,000 left by the end of 1969. Coleman Young summed up what the riot meant this way. The heaviest casualty was a city. The riot put Detroit on a fast track to economic desolation, mugging the city, and making off with incalculable values in jobs, taxes, dollars, and just plain damn money. He added, the flight of business and businesses was just as dramatic and even more devastating. Coleman Young's been dead for a decade now, and most Detroiters were born after those black days in July. But 40 years later, the end of their effects is nowhere in sight.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's senior political analyst. One of those lasting effects of 1967 has to do with how the rest of the state views Detroit. People perceive Detroit as violent, corrupt, and in decay. As Steve Carmody reports, that's crippled the state's relationship with its largest city.
Perception and reality. When it comes to how the rest of the state views its largest city, the perception can be quite striking. For example, when freshman Congressman Tim Walberg was a guest on a Lansing radio station talk show last March, he drew a comparison between Detroit and Iraq.
That 80-85% in a conservative fashion of the country is reasonably under control, at least as well as Detroit or Chicago or any of our other big cities. That's an encouraging sign.
Now, I've never heard Iraq compared to Detroit before.
Well, in fact, in many places, it's as safe and cared for as Detroit.
Walberg insists he was just quoting Michigan soldiers who served in Iraq, and the intent was to relate how parts of the country are relatively peaceful. Still, the casual comparison of Michigan's largest city to a war zone can be a little jarring.
I was stunned.
That's Jack Ebling. It was on his show on WILS that Walberg made his Detroit-Iraq comment.
I've never been to Iraq. I don't know what the situation is there. But I would think when you have a situation with 3,500 Americans being killed over a five-year period, that's not exactly what I sense when I go to Detroit.
But Ebling concedes many of his mid-Michigan listeners do perceive Detroit as a kind of war zone, a perception reinforced by photos of soldiers patrolling the city streets 40 years ago. Lansing State Journal columnist John Snyder says the lingering images of the 67 riot colors Detroit's relationship with the rest of the state.
When, for example, it comes time to dole out money, the legislators sometimes pressured by their out-of-Detroit constituents to almost kind of punish Detroit sometimes for being Detroit.
Snyder says that not only hurts Detroit, but the state as a whole. Dr. Joe Darden is an urban and social geographer at Michigan State University. He's made studying Detroit and the state's African-American population his life's work. Darden says much of Detroit's image problem today stems from the negative images of its past, including the 67 riot.
Those who have a more positive image of Detroit are those who know most about it. I think that the least one knows about it, the more the stereotype comes out in a negative way.
So, perhaps after 40 years, Detroit simply needs a new public relations approach,
not to woo the rest of the nation, but to convince its fellow Michiganders the city is not a dangerous place. Michael Lane is with Marks Lane Public Relations, one of the state's largest public relations firms.
You know, they've come up with various slogans and logos. It's not a matter of sloganeering and creating, you know, beautiful graphics. It's reality on the ground.
Sitting in his 18th floor office overlooking the city's waterfront, Detroit Regional Chamber President Richard Blouse acknowledges the perception problem the city has with the rest of the state. He is optimistic the fading memories of the 67 riot are being eclipsed with more positive images. For example, he points to the recent successes of the city's sports franchises. Still, Blouse admits Detroit's future is tied to the perception the rest of the state has towards the city.
I think we have to care. We would really hope that somebody in Grand Rapids would speak very positively about Detroit and this region, just as I would of Grand Rapids and what is happening there. I can't emphasize this enough. We're all in this together.
I'm Steve Carmody.
One police
officer, they have no concern for us.
White officer
was commenting.
After the riot, whole city blocks were gone.
The lasting impact for me is I lost my dad.
And it was never the same for me.
Donna Daines was in her early 20s in 1967.
I grew up in Highland Park, Michigan. On my particular street, there were 21 kids. Everyone had bikes. We could ride to the library. We could ride up to Tom's Market on the corner of Woodward Avenue. It was an idyllic place to grow up from my point of view. When that whole period of the riots happened, it just seemed to me that that neighborhood turned from dappled green into grit. There were helicopters going over, you know, low overhead. There were Jeeps and National Guards people rumbling up and down our alley. I mean, it was our alley. This was our universe. It was never the same for me. And, you know, intellectually you can say, okay, this is still the same place, but for me, there was sort of a little tectonic shift that changed things. And from that point on, I was eager to live somewhere else as an adult. For the last 30-odd years, I've lived in Battle Creek, Michigan, which in many ways is very much like the Highland Park that I knew before those riots. To see my kids hop on their bikes and ride off in the neighborhood, it was sort of like, oh, okay, this does still exist. And there is a possibility that I can give this to another generation.
Battle Creek resident Donna Daines. The work of rebuilding a neighborhood after devastation is painstaking and slow. The Detroit neighborhood near the intersection where the 1967 riot began is still struggling. Babies born to mothers in this neighborhood die at an alarming rate, and jobs are hard to come by. But it's also a neighborhood that has some attractive assets, including its proximity to large employers and more stable neighborhoods. Sarah Hewlett reports on efforts to get the area back on its feet.
If you walk into the Joseph Williams Recreation Center on Rosa Parks Boulevard, you would never know that Detroit is a city struggling with population loss. The rec center is popular with all ages, but the seniors who come here are especially devoted. They mostly come to play cards. On a recent afternoon, Curtis Martin was schooling a younger man in a game of coon can.
Now the ace, okay, tray.
Martin was born and raised in Detroit. He was 34 years old when the streets of his neighborhood erupted in violence during the summer of 1967. He says in the years after that, promises were made to the neighborhood. And Martin says for a while, corporate leaders like Henry Ford II made good on them.
Ford put on a hardcore program. He said, we don't care if you can read, write, or what. All we want to do is put you to work so you won't be tearing up everything. Come on out and get a job. Anybody.
But then the auto industry fell on hard times, and Martin says promises to rebuild neighborhood stores failed to materialize.
I'm sitting here in front of a mall, a mini mall on 12th and Euclid. And do you know it took them approximately 16 to 18 years to build this little mall?
The strip mall next door to the recreation center has a discount grocery along with a dollar store, a payday lender, and a few small fast food restaurants. But there's nowhere near the variety of goods and services you used to be able to buy on 12th Street. Just ask Tilly Foster. She lives up the street in a housing development that replaced the commercial strip following the civil disturbance.
Come on in. I keep it kind of dark.
Foster used to shop in this neighborhood before the businesses were destroyed.
You could get anything and everything that you wanted on the street.
And now?
You can't get anything anymore because there's no stores here. Everybody's gone. When Farmer Jack left, which I thought was really crazy, then Rite Aid left.
But this neighborhood also has a lot going for it. Henry Ford Hospital and its 7,000 employees are here. Much of the housing stock is in good condition, and it's surrounded by stable, more affluent neighborhoods. Some of the people trying to capitalize on those assets are the leaders of Foster's Church. Tridestone Baptist Church is a former synagogue, and there are still reminders of its Jewish heritage. On the front of the building, you can still see the outline of a menorah. Inside each of the pews has a Star of David carved into the wood. Reverend Richard Wilson is the pastor. He's created an economic development model he hopes will buoy the neighborhood around the church.
We call it revenue for purpose rather than revenue for profit.
Here's how it works. The church's economic development arm launches businesses that hopefully make money. After-tax profits go to the church to reinvest in the community. So far, the church has successfully launched two business ventures. One sells bagels to area hospitals. The other is an insurance company. Wilson has assembled a team of about 15 people he calls his technocrats. Chris Aldrich is one of them. He calls the neighborhood an unpolished gem.
What you have here is an opportunity for people who earn less than $18,000 a year to actually own a house and to start building intergenerational wealth.
Getting there will be a long, slow process. But Reverend Wilson says he thinks it's possible.
I really do. I promise I wouldn't stay if I did.
I'm Sarah Hewlett.
The riots did they hurt Detroit? Sure they did, but those days are over.
When I look around at this beautiful river walk, I'm very impressed. When I go downtown at 3 a.m. to gamble or whatever, I feel very safe.
One thing will build on the next, on the next.
I think they're starting to do good work.
Once I get over the racial issue, I think Detroit will thrive, just like New York and Chicago and all the other towns.
Ashes to Hope, Overcoming the Detroit Riots, was produced by Tamar Charney and Vincent Duffy, with help from Jennifer Guerra and Lester Graham. Production assistance from Zoe Clark, Catherine Gorman, and Brendan Lennon. Reporting by Steve Carmody, Vincent Duffy, Jennifer Guerra, Sarah Hewlett, and Tracy Samilton. Dustin Dwyer produced the historical montage. Richie Duchon and Maria Howes produced the first-person memories. Special thanks to WXYZ-TV Detroit, the Walter P. Reuther Library, Wayne State University, Philip Nye, and Jack Lessenberry. I'm Christina Shockley. This documentary is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.